This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'm interviewing Faith Boninger of the University of Colorado Boulder, who recently released a report on schoolhouse commercialism, student privacy, and the failure of policymakers to address these issues. Faith, your report focuses on the digitalization of education and the collection of large amounts of data from students. What do you think is driving this digitalization?
I think primarily it's the desire for profit, to be honest. We've got a tech industry that sees a big opportunity here in education technology, and it's eager to benefit from it. And then also we've got investors that are eager to benefit along with those companies, and also a lot of other companies that aren't necessarily in the tech sector that are seeing an opportunity that they want to get into. So Disney, PBS, a lot of companies that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be doing education now are, because they see that opportunity. And also a lot of people, entrepreneurs, who are looking to get into it.
Is this a new phenomenon, this kind of exploration of the profit possibilities tied into a public institution like schools?
Oh, no, not at all. We've been following in the Commercialism and Education Research Unit at the National Education Policy Center. We've been following commercialism in education for years and years. Our first report came out in 1998. And the first example of a company trying to get into schools that we know of, and perhaps it existed before then, but the first that that we know of was in 1898, where a hardware company did advertise in schools.
So this is something that's been going on for a long time. Do you feel as though there's kind of an increased attention to schools as profit centers now than in the past?
You know, in the 20s, in the 1920s, the National Education Association was so concerned about the influx of propaganda, corporate propaganda and advertising into schools, that they commissioned a report on it, you know. So companies have been trying to be in schools for a really long time, but now digitalization is really opening it up as even more of a center, I think, because now children's data is so valuable.
So when this data is collected, where does it go?
Well, you know, the big problem is that we don't really know. We're not really told. So we do know that in any given situation, the data are collected in data sets and that they're held by the company that created the software, often in the cloud. But from there, we don't know. So if you look at privacy policies, they'll often say that the information may be shared with other partner companies for the specific educational purpose of the software. Sometimes it's used to improve the service provided, but we don't know exactly what that means in any given instance. And then there are other things that could be done with it. Sometimes it could be shared with advertisers and data brokers. It shouldn't be if a company has signed on to the student privacy pledge, but sometimes it is. We don't know how exactly data are retained, how long they're retained, how they're used to improve services, how they're protected from being hacked. And there have been instances of hackings and breaches and so forth, or how they're transferred to a purchaser in the case of sale of the company. An important question when thinking about all these things that we don't know is why we don't know any of them. Why aren't they transparent? Because they could be.
I understand. Isn't it true, however, that much information is already being collected as children and youth surf the web? Why should we be so concerned if it's being collected at schools as well?
Well, you know, the data that are being collected from children in schools is, in a lot of cases, different kind of data. It's additional data. It's performance data. It's behavioral data. Schools are, you know, they've always been considered a protected environment. But when data are collected from children, parents and students don't necessarily know that it's going on and where it's going. So I think that's a concern. There is one school or one set of schools that's a private for-profit school called Alt School. And in those schools, they explicitly tell the children, I've seen it on video, where they explicitly tell the children that everything is recorded, every keystroke, where they're moving around in the classroom, all that stuff. But those children then are aware that it's going on, and their parents are aware, and they are paying to send their children to this school. But most parents who are sending their children to a public school don't expect that kind of data collection. And, by collecting so much data, usually in the background, schools are normalizing data collection and normalizing the funneling of children into the surveillance economy.
Can you provide an example of what this digitalization looks like in practice? You kind of gave us an idea about what's happening at the Alt School. Are there other examples that parents might conceivably see in their own children's public school?
So Alt School, as I said, is a fairly edge example because that's a private school. But very popular in public schools is using Google's G Suite for Education that Google provides for free to schools. And more of that can be in conjunction with the school providing a Google Chromebook to each student in what they call a one-to-one program. And just a quick piece of data, in 2016, Chromebooks were 58% of the devices that were shipped to K-12 schools. So that's a pretty large proportion. And when a school uses G Suite for Education for its students, either with or without a Chromebook, each student is given a Google account. And that has some implications. So Google claims not to use the information associated for the G Suite for Education accounts to target students with advertising. Okay, so let's assume that's true. It does collect a lot of information from students for other purposes. So it collects information such as the hardware models, the operating system versions, unique device identifiers, queries, system activity, hardware settings. And then, of course, a student can easily surf between the G Suite for Education core services like Gmail and Calendar that are protected, that are privacy protected, to other Google services that aren't privacy protected, like YouTube and search. So there's a lot of mixing between the privacy protected applications and the non-privacy protected applications. And students aren't going to pay attention to this. They're not going to log off of their G Suite account in order to, watch a video or do a search. And they're not going to log off when they surf to other non-Google owned services that do openly track for advertising purposes. So that's something that's very popular.
In your report, you focus a lot on algorithms. It seems like there's a lot being written about them lately, and certainly that's true in what you've written. It would be helpful to define this term for our listeners and for you to say more about what's so problematic about using these tools for educational purposes.
So an algorithm is a procedure for solving a mathematical problem in a finite number of steps. That's the official definition. And a simple way of thinking about it is as a recipe. It tells the computer what to do in a series of steps. But when you think about it that way, it sounds very cut and dried, very neutral. And in actuality, an algorithm is a recipe that operationalizes a theory. And in the case of the algorithms that power educational software, these are theories that are being implemented about how children learn and how children should be taught. And so the real issue here is that the algorithms aren't public, they're proprietary, right? So educators, teachers, parents, students, nobody knows exactly how they're working, what they're doing, what theories of education they're theories of learning they're implementing with the students. We don't know how the program is spitting out conclusions, judgments about the students, how it's telling the students where they should go next. So that, those are the real concerns, that algorithms are not neutral. They're implementing particular theories of learning, and that we don't know how they're doing that in any given instance because they're proprietary.
In your report, you talk about how many of the people who are creating these algorithms are kind of young white men whose orientation is largely individualistic and competitive. How do you see that potentially playing out in terms of the values and the philosophies that lie behind their educational decisions?
Well, you know, there's been a lot lately about, in the news, about the discrimination and stereotyping in the tech world. So tech companies tend to be homogenous, very few women, very few minorities. And, you know, the machine learning algorithms, that they are learning from the data that they're given. And so it's concerning how they're learning, that these algorithms are picking up the same kinds of biases that exist in people. We tend to think that they're going to be better than us, right? That the computers are going to be neutral. They're going to be improvements on people. But actually, they're learning the same kinds of biases that that people have. And, you know, let me give you an example that I found particularly disturbing recently, which is that natural language processors have been found to have trouble understanding Black English. So there was a study done, I believe it was out of UMass Amherst, looking at how natural language programs were interpreting. And it turned out that they were having trouble interpreting Black English, and often saying that those people were speaking in Danish. And so if it's misunderstanding how they're speaking, thinking that people are speaking in a different language because the programs just can't understand it because they've learned to only understand white English, then what happens when you start recording kids, you know, and interpreting the answers that they're providing in an educational setting? Is it possible that a Black student is going to be misinterpreted, whether the program thinks it's speaking Danish or just doesn't understand what the child is saying? The program would interpret that the child doesn't understand the concept, doesn't understand what they're learning. And I think that's really a concern. And it's not that anybody is trying to embed biases into the software that they're creating. It's what happens.
So this seems like an example of what's called personalized learning, something that you're quite critical of. What about the advantages, though? It seems as though personalized programs allow students to oftentimes work at their own pace, make learning more engaging, and provide teachers with important information about whether students are mastering the concepts they're supposed to learn. Aren't these advantages significant? And why is the practice of personalized learning so problematic?
So that all sounds great, those advantages. And then personalized learning in a general sense is a fabulous thing. And I'd like to point out that computerized personalized learning is not the only way to personalize learning for children. And then when you start to look at actual programs, there are a whole bunch of questions that arise. So, one is, how much are they really personalized? Do they give children agency, really? Or how much do they just give them a bunch of things to learn and let them play around with the order in which they learn them? Are they really engaging, or are they basically putting children in cubicles, more or less, and telling them to work on the computer? Another important question is, do they separate the teacher from the student because the program's feedback is mediating what the teacher knows about the student? So instead of having a teacher and student interact directly, and the teacher getting to know the student as a learner and as a person, what the teacher knows is the information about the student that the program provides. And so that mediation may be a problem. And also the use of a personalized learning program may push out the possibility of spontaneous learning opportunities that can arise with a class or a student. So what I'm getting at is that the notion of personalized learning is fabulous, but at the same time, we need to be critical about what the concept really means and also how it's operationalized in any given instance. We need to be careful about buying too quickly into the marketing hype about digitalized, personalized learning programs.
Over 300 companies have signed a pledge to safeguard student privacy that we were talking about earlier. These companies, including big players such as Google and Apple, make some pretty significant promises, such as to not sell student information, to not build profiles on students except for what's authorized for educational purposes, and to maintain comprehensive security. And violations are legally enforceable. Can you explain why, in your opinion, that the student privacy pledge isn't enough?
Sure. So first of all, over 300 companies have signed the student privacy pledge. It's worth knowing that. And, you know, there are a lot of loopholes in it. Particularly, it's not really enforceable. That's not really true, because theoretically, anybody can submit a complaint to the FTC if they notice a violation. But the FTC seems uninclined to address complaints. When I called them to ask, you know, what if I had a complaint, they basically said that they would file it, you know. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation in 2015 submitted a complaint against Google, and the FTC has not acted on that yet. So the lack of enforceability, I think, is a real drawback to that pledge.
What about laws to protect student privacy? Doesn't FERPA protect students' data? And aren't there state laws that get at this issue?
Yeah, sort of. FERPA stands for the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and it applies to almost all public and private schools and provides the primary set of regulations that govern student privacy in the United States. But FERPA was written a long time ago, in the 1970s. So that was before all of this computerized data collection. And, you know, there have been attempts on the part of the education department to update it, but you know, to provide clarifications, but it really, really, really needs an overhaul, a satisfactory overhaul. And there have been some attempts to revise it in recent years, but they haven't been successful. So FERPA's scope is limited to educational records, which means that the legislation doesn't protect items like data collected by education websites or digital pupil-generated content, such as essays that might find their way into being collected, unless personally identifiable information is included in those items. And then very important about FERPA is that there are exceptions that allow student records to be disclosed to certain parties or under certain conditions without parental consent. So without consent, school officials can release student records for any educational purpose that they deem legitimate. And in 2008 and 2011, FERPA was weakened when the Education Department expanded the definitions of school officials and authorized representatives. So now the department considers school officials to include contractors, consultants, volunteers, and other parties that an educational agency has outsourced institutional services to, that it otherwise would have used employees to perform. And what this means is that it allows schools to provide data to private companies without parental consent. And what's important to note about all this is that the private companies aren't named something like partners but rather school officials or authorized representatives. So when Google, when the G Suite for Education is used by a school, Google then has the authority of a school official. And that's something that FERPRET, the people who wrote it originally, could never even imagine.
So what should parents be looking for to alert them to the possibility that data is being collected about their children? And what steps could they take to stop this from happening?
Okay, so first of all, data is definitely being collected on children. And the questions are which data, in what context, and where it's going. And schools vary very widely in what's being collected and how they evaluate, whether they evaluate the different applications that teachers may be using and so forth. So it's really, really, really important for parents, to ask questions. That way they'll learn and they'll be able to respond, but they'll also indicate to the school that they're paying attention and demanding accountability in this area. And that's going to be very important. The Parent Coalition for Student Privacy has put together a parent toolkit for student privacy. It's at a website that is studentprivacymatters.org. And parents can use that tool to help them get a better sense of this area and help them learn what kinds of questions to ask teachers and administrators about the software that children are using, about what data is being collected, about how it's being used, and what school and district policies are.
What about teachers? If they are concerned about corporations collecting data like these about their students, what actions could they take to curb these activities?
They can also ask questions, and I would recommend to teachers also going and taking a look at the Parent Coalition for Student Privacy's Parent Toolkit. I think that will help them be able to respond to parents who are asking questions and also help them ask their own questions. They should be very, very careful about making sure that they're using only district-approved software with the children, because if you've got a district that is actually vetting software for privacy concerns, that's the software that teachers should be using and not other things that they might be sent or given. And teachers can also work with their unions to demonstrate their concerns about privacy, both for the children and for themselves, because a lot of these products are without a doubt tracking teachers.
Finally, what's your bottom line? What do you recommend?
So the thing is, there's no great hurry to implement digital technologies in schools. Sometimes it feels like that, but there really isn't a hurry. Instead, the goal should be to make very sure that children's privacy is adequately protected and that educational software programs do what they're claimed to do and don't harm children in any way. We need to make sure that goal of making sure that the children are protected is in place before we start to implement particular digital technologies in schools. And so decision makers shouldn't rely on things like the Student Privacy Pledge to protect children's privacy and the quality of their education. Instead, legislators and policymakers should create clear policies, and we have some recommendations for what those policies could contain. So policies should be enforceable, and they should hold companies, in addition to schools, accountable. So FERPA only holds schools accountable. New policies should hold companies accountable as well. Policies should require full transparency. So the algorithms that are driving educational software applications shouldn't be held behind a wall labeled proprietary, but rather be open for examination by educators and researchers. And schools and districts really aren't equipped to evaluate software. So policy needs to establish and fund a disinterested third-party entity that will be capable of examining the algorithms for bias and error, for evidence that the software is producing the results that are intended, and to assess the potential threats that they may pose to students' well-being. I'm not done. I have so many things to say. And then finally, you know, as I mentioned earlier, parents, teachers, and administrators, as individuals and through their organizations, should work to publicize both the potential threats that unregulated educational technologies may pose to children, and also the importance of allowing access to the algorithms that are powering educational software.
That's a useful list of recommendations. Are there any people at the federal or the state level, legislators or policymakers, who have expressed interest and concern about these issues that our listeners could potentially touch base with to express their own concerns?
Well, I know that Al Franken has, on the federal level, has expressed interest in privacy. Markey, also, there are several congresspeople who have sponsored legislation in the past couple of years to update FERPA, so they would be people to look for. In any given state, you know, if you look up on, let's say, openstates.org student privacy legislation, interested parents or teachers or administrators can see who sponsored them in the state and then turn to them.
So thanks for being with us for our interview with Faith Boninger today. Thanks, Faith, for your participation. This is Greg Smith. Next month's education interview will be with Alyssa Dunn from the University of Michigan. And we'll explore the topic of teacher resignations linked to the neoliberal education reform movement and the use of online forums to reclaim the voice of classroom teachers in the face of governmental and corporate silencing. We invite you to join us for that conversation. And thank you for, again, listening to our conversation today with Faith Boninger.